Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says why? Because we like you. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And this is going to be part two of our discussion about copyright, creativity, and the future of intellectual property. This was based on an email from our listener, Dave. So if you haven't heard part one of this discussion, go back to our last podcast, listen to that episode, then come back and dive right into this one.
Because it's in medias res, y'all.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk a little bit about alternatives to this copyright. Just if you're an artist and you want to create a work, and you want to have some protection of your work, but you also want people to be able and feel feel like they can totally take that work and tweak it in some way, make something new.
Rather than attaching a letter of intent to every single piece of thing that you create.
Yeah. What do you do? Well, one thing you could do is use something like a public copyright license, which is a way for original authors to grant copyright permissions under specific conditions, depending upon whatever the license says. And there are a lot of different types out there, but the most famous would be the Creative Commons license. And this came about because there were a group of people who were saying, you know, I want to create a way for creators to be able to put their works out and have that peace of mind, but also to encourage creativity in the community. So not just be, a black and white, don't use my stuff. It is guarded for my entire lifetime plus another 70 years. So copyright doesn't really have that flexibility, right? There aren't grades of copyright. So you have to create these licenses. And licensing is one of those things that most people don't have, you know, the ability to do. You need lawyers in there. And it's just one of those things where if you are an individual artist, you might feel like you don't have a means of doing this. That's where Creative Commons came in, a not-for-profit organization that did this work on the behalf of artists.
Mm-hmm.
So that artists can then use these licenses free of charge and define how their work may or may not be used. The organization itself was founded in 2001 and released its first set of licenses in 2002, which was version 1.0. They revised those licenses over time. And here are the six main ones. So here are the six main types of Creative Commons license. The CC BY license, which allows others to use your original work as they see fit, even for commercial purposes, as long as they attribute you for the original creation. So this is their widest, like the mm-hmm. one that has the most leniency, right? So if I create something and Joe, you think, I'm going to remix that work and then I'm going to end up selling it on, you know, some music site. You could totally do that under this license. There's nothing preventing you from doing it. And I've given you permission through that license, even though my original work is technically under copyright.
Though I would think a question might be, how do I attribute you?
Well,
can I do it in some little piece of fine print somewhere, or do I need to?
Technically, it depends. But I mean, yes, you could. Like for something like a song, it tends to be within the data, like the metadata for mm-hmm. the song.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have to have an announcement on before the song starts, like, I remixed this song from Jonathan Strickland, and it was cool, but I made it cooler. Enjoy. You wouldn't have to do that.
There are specific rules. These are the basics of Creative Commons.
Right.
There are very specific rules laid out on their website.
Exactly. Next is the CC BY-SA, which lets others build on your work, like the one I just mentioned, even for commercial use. But those who do also must abide by the same agreement. So that means that I would grant Joe the permission to remix my work.
Mm-hmm.
But as part of that agreement, Joe also has to license it under this same type of Creative Commons license.
So that I could take Joe's work and transform it into my own.
Exactly. And you would have to continue to agree.
Yeah.
So this is supposed to be to foster creativity and sharing.
The pay it forward model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Wikipedia operates under this particular Creative Commons license. Next, you have the BY-ND Creative Commons license, which allows for redistribution for commercial and non-commercial use, but the work cannot be changed in any way and must remain whole with credit to the original author. So you could freely distribute this work, but you couldn't chop it up. You couldn't remix it. You couldn't, you would have to, you know, keep credit to the original creator of the work. BY-NC allows for non-commercial tweaking and building upon an original work with credit to the original author. So you could do, you could, you know, remix something to your heart's content, but you couldn't sell it. You couldn't make money from it. You couldn't generate revenue that way. BY-NC-SA is the same as above, only now all new creations must be licensed under those exact terms. So it's similar to what we were talking about before. Non-commercial use. I create something. Joe creates a remix. He has it under that same license. Lauren creates a remix. Neither Joe nor Lauren can sell their stuff. I could technically sell mine, but mm-hmm. you couldn't sell the remixes of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have BYNC, which lets others remix and build upon your work, but only for non-commercial use, and also acknowledge the original owner. So those are the six main types. There's also the ability to put work directly into the public domain, which is kind of cool. You do have to fill out some paperwork so that it acknowledges that you have relinquished ownership
any rights
of that work.
To write.
Mm-hmm.
Any rights to write.
Yeah, any rights to write. So the idea here is, again, to give artists the ability, some options, you know, as opposed to just either full protection or you don't pursue any protection. You need to have some leniency in there so that you can foster creativity, but under the terms that you feel comfortable with, so that you can still make money if that's what you're choosing to do with whatever, you know, whatever your work happens to be.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, and we're going to look into the future of copyright, but right now, if nothing changes, the Steamboat Willie version of Mickey Mouse will enter the public domain in 2023.
But that's not going to happen.
No, probably not.
Yeah, because that's creeping up.
Yeah, coming up pretty quickly. I would imagine there are already some serious talks behind closed doors, whether at corporations or Congress or both, about extending copyright protection even further than it has already been extended.
Well, you know, Walt Disney's head and, you know, whatever.
Under the Pirates of the Caribbean ride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably has something to say about it.
Right. We watch too much Futurama. But yeah, so this is where we get into that issue. You know, I think all of us agree that the creator of a work should at least be allowed for the expectation of generating revenue from that work in some way. Whether they pursue it or not is beside the point. They should at least have that expectation that that is an option.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this balance between protecting that artist or owner and protecting the public and other artists who could enhance that work use that work in some other means, some other transformative means, without fear of being sued to the ends of the earth and back. And now that we have these corporations in place, and the corporations, like we said, don't die of old age, they have every incentive to keep pushing that copyright limit until it's at truly ridiculous length. Mm-hmm. Some would argue that we're already there. I mean, life of the creator in 70 years is a long time.
You still can't sing the song Happy Birthday without paying royalties.
Technically. So that's, we won't be doing that today. Luckily, it's no one's birthday. It's no one's birthday, right?
No.
Happy, 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 happy.
That's about as close as we're going to get. So, yes. Yeah,
birthday.
So I'm guessing that we're going to see this continue, and we're also going to see more resistance, but it's probably going to be on the sort of independent artist side, where you have artists who don't want to pursue this same pathway that corporations are pursuing, and yet still need to make a living so that they can continue to make art.
Oh yeah.
So I think we're going to continue to see those public copyright licenses being pushed, but this is tricky. I think we're gonna just keep seeing actual official copyright law get more and
extended.
More
extended. Yeah.
Now, Joe, before we recorded this podcast, we were just kind of talking over ideas. You brought up an interesting kind of sci-fi idea about one element of copyright. What was that?
Oh, well, it's this idea of fixed in a tangible medium. You remember that from earlier on?
Mm-hmm.
So your work, if you want to claim copyright on it, has to be fixed in a tangible medium. You have to write it down or record it if it's music. It can't just be something that was ephemeral and can no longer be accessed, like a thought or an improvisational performance that wasn't recorded.
Right.
Or something like that.
It can, however, be something that's, you know, written down on in computer memory, which some people would argue doesn't seem terribly tangible because it feels like it's ethereal. But in fact, it actually is tangible.
Sure. Well, that's one way in which we've extended the ways in which fixed in a tangible medium can apply to new types of things. So now that we have recording equipment, electronic recording equipment, you can record performances of music that might have been improvised on the spot.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. If you want that half-hour jam session from Dave Matthews Band,
yeah,
then they can copyright that.
Yeah.
Or you
can even copyright a performance of a work that otherwise was in public domain.
Sure, of course, totally.
Yeah, and so by adding this new technological recording capability, we're covering more of the types of works you can create under copyright, and I wonder how far that can go. I mean, number one, I just wonder about, okay, so if we're recording more and more of our lives, if recording media become super pervasive, they already are very pervasive, how much more of the ephemera of our lives can be copyrighted and claimed as art? Can, you know, if you're just recording all the conversations you have with your friends,
copyright a conversation? Sure.
Yeah. If you're recording all the humming you do, just random humming while you're walking around, if someday later you hear a song, you're like, that sounds like something I hummed, and you can go back and find it.
Yeah.
Are we giving
in song what I'm doing a lot.
Yeah.
As everyone around the office
knows. I think
you
did it yesterday.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. So I mean, like, is my great hit, I'm going to the refrigerator, going to be a breakaway pop thing next year?
Well, just with the threat of this.
Can I sue about it? Sorry,
it could
ahead.
Have even more of a chilling effect on the creation of new works.
Sure.
If there's just more and more out there all the time that somebody could raise an issue with, like, hey, this sounds like something that I created once and didn't ever plan on doing anything with. And then if we want to get even weirder, what if we think about the ability to scan our brains? I mean, obviously right now we don't have the ability to scan your brain with an EEG and say, okay, you're thinking of a yellow house on a coastline by a tree. But the fact that you are having that thought is in some way physical. And we could imagine in the future that there might be ways that you could detect the contents of somebody's thoughts by scanning their brain.
Your brain is a tangible medium.
Right. And so at that point, is a recorded brain scan of an idea of something that's fixed in a tangible medium?
Well, the recording would be, but I would argue the memory itself is not fixed and tangible. It is tangible, but not fixed.
But once you scan it and make a recording,
the scanning would be fixed, but not the idea.
That is true, because memories change all the time.
That's right. Every time we remember, we're trying to rebuild that original neural pathway that was formed upon the creation of that memory. But every time we remember, we alter that a little bit. So, therefore, the memory itself cannot be fixed, but the scan itself could be. So then you would argue, well, the scan's protected, but does that protection extend to whatever the idea was? And if it was a specific idea, but then you went and wrote something else down, that would technically be a transformative work. Because it wouldn't be exactly the way you thought of it when you created it.
Would you have to sue your own brain?
I've often thought about suing my own brain, to be honest. There have been times where I just thought, it's particularly whenever I'm feeling really good about myself, and then my brain digs up that memory of when I did something really terrible in elementary school and says, you're really a terrible person. You should remember that.
Aww.
Yeah, that happens. That's not a joke. All right. So
anyway. Me too. Yeah. Those are good times, brain. Thanks, brain.
But we've got a couple of other interesting points that Dave brought up, right?
Yeah. He asked in his email about fan-created derivative of works, like fan fiction and stuff like that.
Very good point.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually a lot of conversation around this going on, or some conversation at the very least, because the internet has allowed people to consume more and also to comment more.
Yeah, We see a lot of this development happen as technology allows for more expression, right?
Oh, yeah.
The printing press obviously was one of those things that was going to push forward this concept, because suddenly there was the capacity to copy works on a much larger scale than previously. And now we've gotten to a point where it is much easier to create a derivative work and distribute it globally.
rather than just, writing a story and passing it around in class or something like that.
Yeah, and another thing is that we are living in an age where fan fiction and these kinds of derivative works actually can become big money makers.
Right.
It's not just something that's taking place for fun on the side. Like, think about, though I hate to introduce
Fifty Shades of Grey.
To the world of this podcast, 50 Shades of Grey, it's an erotic novel series that apparently began as Twilight fan fiction.
And they're releasing the movie on Valentine's Day. How messed up is that? All right.
Well, let's not get into this movie.
Issue.
But anyway, this is fan fiction that became a huge moneymaker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Originally fan fiction, at least.
Yes.
It was deemed transformative enough that as long as the author changed the names, it was totally legit.
Okay. I mean, you can see why people would be concerned about this.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, and the concern goes back to basically the time at which more people were getting access to the internet. Back in the 90s and 2000s, huge corporations like Fox and Warner Brothers and Lucasfilm started sending out cease and desists and sometimes pursued greater actions against fan websites. Which sounds so crazy when you say it out loud.
Yeah.
But it was especially the kind of websites that were either operating under URLs that they wanted.
Right. Like StarWarsFan.com or something like that.
Something like that. Or HarryPotterWorld.co.uk.
Right.
And fans that were posting what these corporations deemed to be too much of their content. Now, in general, companies have backed off of lawsuits like this as long as fans have shown that they're not operating for profit.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, obviously, it's a risky PR move to make to go against your fan base, the people who are the most passionate supporters of your work. And then to say, don't use the stuff you love.
It seems
they do it.
Yeah.
A lot of the businesses behind beloved media these days don't really seem to care very much if the fans end up hating them. I mean, you could say the same thing about like DRM and stuff. There are just lots of companies. They're making media that people love. They're taking tactics that people don't like, but.
Well, to be fair,
where else are they going to go?
These corporations are also huge, and so it can always be that there are certain departments that are working with very different directives than other departments.
Oh, absolutely. I imagine that a lot of actual, say, recording artists are not necessarily fans of the DRM rules,
Meanwhile, there's another element to this internet world, right? Engagement!
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, so it's all really complex because fans are gaining access to more media and to more online communities that encourage participation in that media.
Mm-hmm.
Not just consumption, but actual participation. And so, and like you were saying, Jonathan, like it's kind of free marketing for the media.
Yeah.
So they should like it, right? But it's also uncontrollable, which makes a lot of big corporations really twitchy.
Yeah.
And furthermore, the consumer creators are using for-profit web spaces to post and access this content, which means that third parties like Facebook and Tumblr and YouTube are profiting from this fan creation process. And in some cases, like YouTube, the fan can be profiting indirectly through ad revenue. And in some cases, the third party can claim some ownership of the fan's works, depending on those terms of service.
Right. So in your YouTube example, let's say that I create a YouTube video that is deemed by the original owner of the work that I have incorporated in my video to be, not transformative or derivative or whatever. They're not going to pursue legal action. They instead go through YouTube. YouTube actually allows for that owner of the original work to gather the revenue generated by that, the one that I created.
Mm-hmm.
So if I create something that pulls a ton of video from Star Wars, as an example,
Like from the new Star Wars trailer, for example.
Sure. And let's say that the my video is not appreciably that much longer than the trailer, and the trailer takes up a good deal of my video. Then it could very well be that if I decide to run an ad in front of it, instead of taking it down, instead of blocking me, the owner says, all right, well, just any revenue that video generates, send it to me instead. And they could totally do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and I think a lot of us would argue that's depending upon the extent of that use, that might be kind of fair.
Kind of the best of all possible tricky, sticky situations.
It's definitely better than getting sued.
Yeah, there's another aspect to this that is interesting in theory, and I don't want to be too explicit about what I mean, but there are certain types of perhaps transformative works that could take somebody's intellectual property and do something new with it in a way that the original creator really might not like on a purely thematic level.
You're talking slash fic.
Yeah.
Mainly, yeah.
Stuff like that. Okay, so imagine I write a series of stories online that are about, I don't know, Darth Vader and Boba Fett being lovers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I end up making a good bit of money with this. What's Lucas
by selling it independently, like on your asking for donations, maybe, or
sure.
Okay.
What does Lucasfilm have to say about that?
I'm pretty sure they're going to send you a cease and desist.
Yeah. Well, and the key is if you're making money off of it, and that's really the key to any of this is that, I mean, kind of the rule of thumb is that if you're not profiting from it, most companies won't go after
you. Yeah, they just sort of, they assume that the effort of doing so is greater than any benefit they stand to, in the case of getting you to stop doing mm-hmm. what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's something that ends up being like, you know, it's again, fostering the community, they may think, well, that's not really where we're never going to go in that direction. We're never going to create anything officially that's in that same vein because that's not what this universe or story is about from our perspective as the owners of that intellectual property. But we're also not going to stop people from doing it because there's no actual harm done to the brand or whatever mm-hmm. it may be. Then chances are nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. In general, in fact, from having kind of listened in on conversations that authors were having on the internet, a lot of authors these days stay as far away from fan fiction of their works as possible, because if they do read something in a fan work and wind up incorporating any element of that into a later work of their own,
they have violated copyright.
They can transversely violate copyright law. Exactly.
Man.
Yeah. Even though they created the work that was transformed, if they copy the transformed work, that's a violation of copyright.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do not send your ideas for the Dresden Files, for example, into Jim Butcher because...
Right.
He'll just dislike you.
This is the same reason why if you ever create, you want to write a script on spec for a television series, it might be a better idea to send a script for a different TV series
mm-hmm.
to that creative team to show them what your writing skills are like and how you put a story together, because most of those companies won't even look at an on-spec script for their series for fear of that very thing happening.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to learn more about this general topic of fan-created works, a guy named Henry Jenkins has written a whole lot about it and has really interesting, savvy things to say. So I recommend looking him up if you're curious about it.
Cool. So one of the things we wanted to wrap up with was what would happen? Wouldn't it be interesting if somehow there could be a monumental shift in the government's view of the value of copyright? What if we were to see an overcorrection, or maybe just a correction, depending upon your point of view? I'm sure the corporations consider this an overcorrection. But a correction to move it back toward more what it was originally intended to be, a 14-year period of protection.
I could be convinced otherwise if somebody had a really good argument they wanted to offer me, but I think that would be a much better situation, even just the original 14 years and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it seems like that's enough. I mean, if your work is successful, you can make a decent amount of money off of it in 14 years. That seems to me a totally reasonable amount of time for something to be protected by copyright.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's I could argue, you know, if you're Van Goghing it and you really don't hit popularity until very late in your life, if not at all.
Maybe in that case, there could even be some kind of clause of some kind, like
How many billions of dollars, if you hit a cap of how much this artwork is worth,
right?
Maybe. I mean, it's harder with art. It's harder with pieces of art because that's a one thing that you can sell or prints of that thing. Obviously, if people are making prints of it, that would be different. Because if it's out of the copyright, everyone can make a print of that work, then you wouldn't see any revenue from it if it has already passed that 14 years.
You can still see revenue from something that people have made prints of. That's certainly not.
Well, if it's out of copyright, they can make prints of it themselves and not pay you anything.
Well, yeah, but the original artwork, we've argued about this before actually on the show. The original Van Gogh is obviously worth more than a print of it because there's magical properties involved in the Van Gogh painting.
But the original Van Gogh painting will only be sold by the owner once, and then it's over.
That's
true. So if you've created this original work before you made it famous and you sold it for a pittance because you hadn't yet made your name.
Sucks to be you.
Yeah, that's the way life works, baby. Is the way the way I look at that. So I actually wouldn't mind seeing this return either. As someone who creates stuff, I obviously see the value again of having that protection. But I also don't think it necessarily needs to last my entire lifetime plus 70 years.
Yeah, well, working in the space we do, we can see it from both sides. I mean, we would like to be able to not just rip people off, but to fairly use works without having to worry about, oh, are somebody going to try to sue us?
Yeah, if I take this down. Yeah, if I had sung Happy Birthday, heaven forbid, on this podcast, would they sue us? And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, you want to be able to avoid that kind of chilling effect. But at the same time, yeah, you do want to have your works protected for a reasonable amount of time that you can make revenue on. 14 years seems to me like a good balance. 28 years, if you want to be more generous.
Real safe, yeah.
How could you need it to be longer than 28 years?
Yeah.
I would agree with 28 years. I'm thinking that if I ever created something that was actually worth money, how would I feel about that?
Again, we are looking at this from the perspective of individuals and not of a giant corporation that is going to exist perpetually without us.
Is that our job here? We need to. What would the corporations want?
What would they feel?
Not so much that's our job, but something that is a consideration. Like if you sit there and think, all right, if I had formed this corporation and the purpose of the corporation is to make money and way of making money is to protect your assets, then you start to understand why certain decisions are being pushed for. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them, but you understand why it's happening.
I think they should create some more art.
I agree.
On Steamboat Willie's coattails forever. One last point, and we've talked a little bit about this before in our 3D printing related episodes, I think, way back when. So technology keeps making pirating or sharing, depending on what side of the argument you're on, easier. So do you guys think that media corporations are ever going to catch up to the distribution speed that fans these days require and expect?
No.
Well, I think they'll catch up, but they'll only catch up to the transmission speeds of like 3 years ago type stuff. It'll always be something that's going to either we get to a point where it's essentially instantaneous delivery, in which case there's not much you can do about it anyway. We're pretty close to that right now, honestly.
Well, I mean more in the sense of, a movie comes out and people want to see it.
Yeah.
And some people are willing to go to a movie theater and see it. Some people are willing to go on Amazon and rent it. And some people are going to download a stolen copy of it.
Well, the argument there is, this is a slippery slope argument where you say that any pirated version is lost revenue, which is not the case. Because you cannot prove that a stolen view of a film or an experience of listening to a song
is a replacement of monetary.
Right. That otherwise that person would have spent the money to experience that. And
this experience was worth free to me, but it is not worth $9.
So the problem there is that if the person was not going to buy it either way, then you haven't lost revenue. It's irritating that someone's experiencing something that you've set a price on and they're doing it for free, but it's not like if they hadn't done that, you would have made that sale. So this is a real argument that the U.S. Office of Ethics looked into about how there were claims from the music industry and the movie industry about how much revenue was being lost due to piracy. And the conclusion was you cannot come up with a number because you cannot determine that every instance of something being stolen would have otherwise been an actual sale.
Yeah, it goes back to not being able to predict behavior.
And it goes back to it being digital rather than physical, right? Mm-hmm. Because if it's physical, then clearly you can't sell a physical thing that's been stolen from you. You don't have it to sell it anymore. So if I'm selling CDs and I have 10 CDs and Sticky Fingers Lauren comes in and steals one of them, I now have 9 CDs. I can no longer sell 10. But if I do digital copies and Lauren copies it, I haven't lost anything. I still have the original code. I can still sell those instances to everyone else. So it's a different experience than when you had a physical good in your hands.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I believe it was a bit by the comedian Mindy Kaling, who was talking about that that old commercial in the movie theaters. It's like, you wouldn't steal a car.
Yeah.
You wouldn't steal a purse, but you'll pirate a movie. And then she thought, you know, I would steal a car if all I had to do was touch the car, and then the car could be mine forever, and the person could keep their car.
Right. Right. It is a very, very different case. And so, I mean, does piracy result in lower revenue? We don't know. We honestly don't know the answer to that. The answer is probably a little bit, but to what extent? Or we don't know. It could be a significant amount. It could be a very small amount, relatively speaking. There's also argument to be made that pirates tend to be people who will go out and buy the stuff they love, that the initial piracy is them sampling stuff. And then the things they like, they actually go out and support. And there's some evidence for that as well. Now, clearly,
there have been a couple case studies. Yeah.
Yeah, there's not like every pirate has a heart of gold and is going to totally shell out the bucks for the stuff they love. There are going to be some people who are going to try and take anything they can get for free. The alternative to that, as far as I see from the corporation's perspective, is make your stuff as easy to buy as possible. Put it on as many platforms as possible. Price it reasonably. Don't add a ton of DRM to it that's going to make the experience negative for people who legitimately purchased your product. The easier you make something to buy, the more likely someone will buy it, which is a little outside the copyright discussion, but it does tie into it. I mean, piracy and copyright are very closely related.
I think I did want to bring it up because I do think that it's a contributing factor to what a lot of corporations are fighting for when
sure.
they fight for copyright.
Right. And it'll definitely be an element that they will argue whenever they advocate for stricter copyright.
They're going to be going, yeah, well, we're losing all of this intangible money to intangible piracy. So.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's I can definitely see where that argument could be made. Not legitimately in my view, but I can see how it could be made.
What is the future of watching, I don't know, the next Star Wars movie filmed on a camcorder on some Chinese YouTube?
It's not in my future because I refuse to do that.
You know, I think that the experience is going to get a lot better as cell phone cameras get better.
Cell phone cameras improve.
Look,
you've got video stabilization technology.
Translation improves. It's not going to be do not want.
Guys, this is how 3D happened. All right. Do you really want the next 3D to happen because we're talking about how easy it'll be to pirate movies?
No.
I don't want another 3D. So let's just, you know, all right. So let's wrap this up. Dave.
Yes.
We got an excellent discussion out of this, an epic, excellent discussion. So thank you so much for sending in that email. We really appreciate it. If you have a question, a comment, you want to know how something's going to work in the future, just send us a message. That email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com or drop us a line.
Joe is in the background giggling about do not want.
Yeah,
sorry, please continue.
I'm going to try. I'm so close. Or drop us a line on Twitter, Facebook, or Google+. At Twitter and Google+, we are FWThinking. Search for FWThinking on Facebook. We will pop right up and we'll be giggling to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.